Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. This hour, we continue our series investigating why the price we pay for healthcare is so much higher than the rest of the world. We pay twice as much as any other country in the industrialized world, with outcomes that are sorely lagging. The lack of transparency as to costs contributes to this, as does the price of pharmaceuticals. We pay much more for those in a system that seems rigged in their favor. But for many Americans, those costs are invisible because they don't pay the full freight for their care or their prescription drugs. Those costs are picked up by insurance, either by Medicare or, for the majority of people under 65, by private employer-paid insurance. But even those with insurance should be concerned about our ever-escalating prices. To cover their costs, insurance companies have to raise premiums. Some employers have stopped participating because they simply can't afford to pick up their share of the costs, and even where companies continue to provide employees with health insurance, those employees are facing higher copays and deductibles. Those rising costs have forced some of them to forego care because they can't afford the deductible. That can worsen outcomes and raise costs when the time arrives where they can no longer ignore a medical problem. To control costs, companies are engaging in new options like virtual care and promoting preventive care and preventive health checkups. But outcomes are often lacking, and many companies insist that a better solution would involve government intervention. Today, we try to get a better understanding of the costs, benefits, and sustainability of employer-sponsored health insurance and how it contributes to the cost of care. Paul Goldbeck is a senior consultant and large market health and group benefits lead at Willis Towers Watson in Charlotte, a company that helps other organizations manage risk and optimize benefits. Welcome to the program. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good to see you. And Dr. Frank Warham is a professor of medicine in the Division of General Internal Medicine at Duke University. Prior to his tenure there, he spent 17 years at Harvard Medical School, where he was director of the Division of Health Policy and Insurance Research. Thank you for joining us, Doctor. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Mike. Great to be here.
And Dr. Michael Chernow is a professor in the Department of Healthcare Policy at Harvard Medical School, where as director of the Healthcare Markets and Regulation Lab, he researches ways to improve the healthcare system. Thank you for being here, too. Welcome.
Great to be here.
And let me begin with you, Michael, with a basic question. There are segments of our society who are profoundly impacted by the high costs of healthcare, and others who have employer-sponsored healthcare benefits who have been largely shielded from higher costs until deductibles began to rise. Is that part of our problem politically, that the vast majority of people don't ever see these costs, don't ever experience these costs, so they don't see it as a problem? Is that why we can't move forward on these things?
I think there's a lot of reasons why we can't move forward. I think the ideological divide and the problems in healthcare would be challenging under any case. But it is certainly true that the system is more responsive when people see the costs in their face when they see care for the premiums they have to pay. So in that sense, I think it's true. I'll just point out that even though they may not feel like they're paying for high healthcare spending, people with employer-sponsored coverage are paying. They're paying in the form of lower wages or other types of costs that they face.
Do you think they understand that? I mean, until your deductible is $5,000 a year, do you understand that the costs are rising and they're impacting you?
I think by and large, many Americans don't understand the complex web of financing that goes on behind the healthcare system. So they're not sure how much of their care they're paying for, how much of other people's care they're paying for, and overall how much is being spent. So no, I don't think the understanding is great. Honestly, I don't understand that well, and I used to chair the Harvard Benefits Committee, so.
Paul Goldbeck, one segment of the economy, I suppose, that does understand this to a certain degree are business owners and companies who are trying to supply their employees with health care. And before we talk about costs to workers, talk a moment about how the rising cost of the pharmaceuticals is impacting the rising cost of insurance for employers who provide it, because premiums have been rising consistently for those employers. How have those companies responded by and large?
By and large, they've responded by trying to engage employees more in their care. And typically that involves offering them resources that are disease focused, resources that are well-being focused, in essence, trying to engage with employees so that they can better manage their own health and by extension, reduce their risks and their cost. I think there's been a lot of argument as to whether any of that has been effective. What I have noticed and what has caused a smile or two during conversations is as long as I've been doing this, the challenges have more or less remained the same. Hmm. Employees don't engage, they don't take care of themselves, they don't do the things employers would like them to do relative to seeking out higher quality, lower cost providers. Vendors don't deliver, vendor partners that is, in the management of the medical plan don't deliver in the ways that employers would like them to. But fundamentally, in my mind, it all boils down to the issue that we started with, namely transparency. The one thing above all, in my opinion, that distinguishes the healthcare market from others is the lack of transparency on price, but also on quality. You don't know what you're going to pay when you walk in the door, and you really don't have a sense of how well off you will be at the end of whatever course of treatment it is you're paying for. And in essence, we're buying something without any of the kinds of knowledge and understanding that we go into other purchases with. And from there comes a huge sense of frustration. And this has been going on for years.
And we've talked a lot about that on other episodes of this series about the price we pay for healthcare. But really, if you're only paying a $25 deductible or a copay, rather, do you care?
Yeah. And to your point, employees place a huge amount of value on having that fixed cost so that when they go to the doctor, they know what it's going to cost. And a copay in your example. And from a employer plan management perspective, employees are willing to pay a lot more on payday for a plan that has fixed copays beyond the actual value of the plan. In other words, I will pay more to have a $25 copay than it really costs the plan, because there is such a psychological component to knowing what I'm going to pay when I go. And that comes back to the transparency issue.
There's also the question, as premiums rise, because I think only 56% of employers offer coverage right now, but as premiums rise, employers have to make a choice. They either pay the higher premiums or they search for a different policy that has higher deductibles but similar coverage for their employees, or they can reduce their workforce so they don't have to provide as many insurance policies to as many employees. What are companies doing when they face that choice?
Well, we do a best practices in healthcare survey every 2 years. And number one, in terms of employee concerns and where their attention was going to be focused in our 2021 survey, was on cost. Cost to the employer and cost to the employee. Affordability to the workforce has become a prime focus, not only for buying the plan in terms of paying for your coverage, because most employers charge something, but also the cost of care when you actually need something from the healthcare market. Most employers have gone, or many employers, probably a better way to say it, have gone to high deductible health plans, as you know, but they've reached the limit of what those plans can accomplish. And many employers are coming back to copay plans now, but charging employees a significant premium to be in those plans. In the end, it's all compensation. And the more your medical plan costs, the less you have for other forms of compensation, whether it's paid time off or other benefits or salary and bonuses. And that is what employers are doing. We've seen stagnation of wages. We've seen the economic impact of having to fund healthcare. And that is one of the primary drivers behind wage stagflation.
Dr. Warham, insurance companies on average pay about 2.5 times, I understand, what Medicare pays to hospitals for the exact same services. Those costs are going to be and have been passed on to those people or those companies buying insurance. Aside from rising premiums, what have been the results? And rising co-pays and deductibles, what have been the results?
Yeah, so, you know, you ask an important question, and I think it's good to think about some of these issues with employers in terms of the large employers and the small employers, because the large employers have flexibility. They can offer options. They can, you know, manage your benefits better. But the small employers are really stuck with where the market is going. And so when those premiums go up, they have a choice to either offer health insurance with very high deductible or get out of the market and not offer health insurance. And so when we do our research about health insurance and high deductibles, we find that it's often the small employers that are taking them up. And those deductibles, you know, when you look at the overall population, you know, everyone who has a high deductible health plan, you tend not to find big problems. You know, you find that cancer screening remains about the same, emergency department use looks okay, visits don't change too much. But it's really when you hone in on the smaller, vulnerable populations that might have a lower income or a chronic illness, that's where we see challenges. We see people delaying care, and we see consequences of those delays. So we see the people, for example, with diabetes, end up with higher rates of complications when they face that large financial barrier to care. And as you indicated at the beginning, those increased complications lead to higher costs. So we do see problems in, for example, low-income, chronically ill people who join high deductible health plans.
And when you say small versus large employers, what are you talking about? What constitutes a small employer?
Well, you know, there's various definitions. People tend to think of smaller employers as having fewer than 100 people. You know, in the Affordable Care Act marketplaces, that tends to be one of the definitions. 50 is another term. So smaller tends to be 50, 100. And those employers, they don't have the resources of the large employers. And Paul really focuses often on those large employers. And he was speaking from their perspective in a lot of ways about what they're trying to do. And I just think it's important to highlight that the smaller employers, they really face the headwinds of these costs in sometimes a stronger way.
And when you say resources, you're talking about smaller companies don't have the bargaining power that the larger companies do. GE is going to have more bargaining power than a toy store down the street in the mall.
Well, that's right. They don't have the bargaining power. They don't have the people, the staff that can understand the marketplace. They don't have the resources to buy a care management program to try to get their people who are chronically ill into the doctor. So they just generally don't have the the means to navigate the market in the way that the large employers do when, you know, they're facing these high costs and the large employers can kind of pivot and try to determine what's a good way to go. But the smaller employers generally don't have the ability to do that.
Michael, some businesses say healthcare has become unsustainable. The cost of it has become unsustainable. Is that true or are they just complaining?
Well, first, let me respond to something that Frank just said, and then I will answer that question. The bargaining power that matters most here is probably the bargaining power of the insurers. So what the small firm does is they pull together with an insurance product, and that ensures the bargaining power that would matter. That's one reason why one value that insurance companies add is they provide some counterweight to prices. As you pointed out, it doesn't work tremendously well in many cases. That's probably for another discussion. In terms of healthcare spending being sustainable, back in the 70s, we thought it was unsustainable. It's still unsustainable. At some point, it will be unsustainable. Mathematically, it's impossible to have healthcare spending growing faster than income overall. But that being said, and the consequences are real. So it's more than just complaining, but it is also a true problem.
That's why I asked the question, because we've been talking about this for 40 years, and every time we talk about it, they say the costs are rising, it's unsustainable, and yet here we are 40 years later, and we're still talking about it. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more in a moment at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the cost of insurance, the rising cost of it to employers, the rising deductibles and copays for employees, and whether this is sustainable and how it defrays costs and adds to costs for folks in the medical system. We're talking about all this with Dr. Frank Warham, MD, professor of medicine in the Division of General Internal Medicine at Duke University, Dr. Michael Chernew, professor of healthcare policy at Harvard Medical School, and Paul Goldbeck, a consultant and large market health and benefits lead at Willis Towers Watson here in Charlotte. Paul, until these costs that companies experience as they buy insurance are passed on in some fashion to employees, those employees, as we've said, don't experience them. And the Kaiser Family Foundation reports that employer-sponsored insurance premiums for families have risen 55% in 10 years. So now the average premium, which the employee never sees, is $20,000 a year for the employer. Employers pick up 70% of that on average, but the rest is on the shoulders of the employee. And even as that has happened, benefits have become less generous, deductibles have risen. Why has this not resulted in both businesses and individuals calling for some kind of action, either to control costs or to provide health care for all?
Well, I guess whether or not it's resulted in a call to action is a debatable point. I think employers have been talking with each other and through their lobbying groups about what to do for a long time. The problem, and I think we talked about this early on, is getting agreement on what the solution is. And in my experience, there's two primary schools of thought. They both agree that healthcare is incredibly complicated and more expensive than it should be in the United States. Then they diverge and they don't agree on anything. One believes because it's so big and complicated, only a big solution, i.e. a government solution, a single payer solution, is the best solution. Others say, no, it's as expensive as it is and as complex as it is because it does not function as a true market for lots of different reasons that evolved over time. And what we need to do is have more transparency on price and quality, engage individuals more in the purchasing process by giving them that information and enabling them to use it when they make healthcare decisions. And if we do that, then prices will moderate. People will shop based on quality and price and user experience, just like they shop for other things. And that will bring costs down. And those two schools of thought will not come to agreement. And because of that, we get a lot of compromise in the middle.
I mean, 90%, according to some surveys, 90% of 300 large company CEOs believe they should advocate for greater transparency and some kind of government action. I don't know that Congress is listening or that they have the ability to hear or act anymore. It doesn't seem that they do. But why is this different from car insurance? I mean, we all know if we have an accident, we take it to a body shop and we know what it's going to cost and the insurance will pick up some of it after our deductible. Why is it not comparable to that, Paul?
There's one big reason. There are multiple reasons. One big one right off the top is your car insurance is priced based on your risk. If you have a DWI and multiple speeding tickets and you complain to a friend about the cost of your car insurance, you're not going to get much empathy because of your driving experience, and insurers are allowed to charge you for that. That would not go over well in a healthcare environment. But one comment I want to make, I see this, I don't think it's a term that I coined, but I think it's very applicable, and that is the idea of retailization in healthcare. I view healthcare today as kind of where the shopping mall was 10 or 15 years ago, a brick and mortar primarily business that has not yet really felt the impact of technology, the internet and all the things that ripple from it, the way that the retail industry has. And fundamentally, how you shop for things has changed in the last 10 years. And we are at the beginning, in my opinion, of a similar wave in healthcare. When you look at where private equity firms are making their investment, you look at what's happening with technology, you look at business combinations, people getting into healthcare like Amazon and Walmart and others, and the business partners they are linking with we are on the verge of some very big changes in turn that I think will address that transparency problem. And I truly believe that we are at more of a tipping point, if that's an appropriate term, than we ever have been before in terms of really changing the way healthcare is delivered. And technology is going to be a big part of that.
The Affordable Care Act mandates, I believe, that any business with 50 or more full-time employees has to offer a health insurance plan to their employees, Michael. There are tax implications for both the company and for the employee in some cases, because the employee can, I think, help pay in some companies, use pre-tax dollars to pay for some of their benefits, which benefits them at tax time. But for the companies, doesn't the fact that the company has to buy these policies on average of $20,000 per employee put American companies at a global competitive disadvantage when you think about other companies in Europe where the government picks it up? Unmute yourself.
The evidence on that, I'm sorry, is a little bit mixed. But I think the bigger pressure comes out of American wages. So there certainly is a challenge for companies that are competing globally if they have to spend $20,000 on health insurance, as you said. But a lot of the pressure, it's all compensation, to quote Paul from earlier. So there will be situations where that is a problem. But I think the bigger problem is it reduces Americans' wages below where they otherwise would have been. There are situations, minimum wage, for example, where that's not true. So there's broad challenges of American competitiveness. Healthcare is a part of that, but I don't think it's the biggest problem. I think the biggest effect of healthcare is coming out of wages.
Has anybody studied whether or not American workers are aware of that, and whether when they are aware of it, that it matters to them? Because as long as they get their healthcare paid for, we can survive on lower wages. Has anybody done a study about that?
I don't know of any study. Maybe Frank or Paul do. Frank, jump in, Frank.
Actually, Michael, I don't know of a study, and we've actually looked. So some colleagues and I, looked into this, and we call this phenomenon financial pollution. We tried to coin a term that would make it at least more apparent to people what's happening. So like you said, people do not understand, workers don't understand that the process of getting insurance and going to the doctor is stagnating their wages. And that's particularly harmful to lower income people whose wages are already lower, and they're going to be stagnating if their employers have to pay increasing amounts. So I think it's an important point to highlight that there's not a lot of research looking into whether people even know this and what are the effects outside of healthcare. In other words, effects on the ability for families to thrive who are lower income because their wages are stagnating.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just going to add, we do a lot of work with employers, essentially asking employees what they value. So you have cost and then you have value. And when you ask employees to do in what's called a conjoint analysis, to talk about what they would be willing to trade one thing for another, they value two things above everything else. And they tend to be one and two, sometimes in different orders, but it's healthcare and it's paid time off. And I believe a lot of that is driven, again, I hate to keep coming back to it, but the transparency question. The biggest value driver, or put a different way, one of the biggest value drivers at the individual employee level for healthcare is fear. Fear that I have no idea what it could cost. It could bankrupt me. So I am going to place a very high value on having medical insurance.
Yeah.
And that's the calculus that employers have to take into account when they're deciding where to spend the money they have in terms of keeping and retaining, getting and retaining the employees they need to succeed.
Michael.
So we've been talking about transparency a lot. I just wanted to mention two related things. The first is, in the previous administration and now still, there are rules for new price transparency rules where hospitals have to release their prices. Not all do, by the way, it's a separate discussion. And soon insurers are supposed to begin to release their prices. The challenge in most of the transparency work has been that employees even when they are given the tools to understand at least prices, quality is a very complicated concept, but at least prices, they tend not to use the tools and they're not even sure what they're actually buying. And so we can have a long discussion about aspects of like, we should give people more information, but even with the information, there's problems. The insurance, as you mentioned, Mike, shields people from the, so if you say it's gonna cost you $5,000, to go to this hospital will cost you $2,000 to go to the other one. But out of pocket, people are only paying, you know, $100. The transparency doesn't work. People may even believe, and I'm not sure they do, that the higher priced one's better because they're paying $100. Why not get the $5,000 one than not? I'll defer to Paul, but employees have been very, very reticent to adopt health insurance plans that facilitate shopping across providers. There's wide variation in prices within the same market. I can't speak to Charlotte, but certainly in Boston, there's huge price variation, and efforts to develop insurance plans to steer people to the lower price places have not met with great popularity. And Paul, I'm sure, can say more about that.
Well, plus many times when you're shopping, so to speak, for healthcare, you're doing it because you're facing an imminent problem that has to be fixed now. Who has time to shop around for that? Frank, I want to come back to something you were talking about, because we've talked about in previous programs how a lot about how uninsured people delay care because they simply can't afford it. And when they do go in because they can't stand it anymore, the taxpayers or the hospitals pick up the bill because they can't pay for their care. Now we have the situation where deductibles have risen to the point where a lot of people can't afford to pay the deductibles, so they forego care. How pervasive is that, and what is the upshot of that when it happens?
Right. So, you know, in terms of how pervasive it is, it's difficult to study these types of delayed events. So I can speak to some of the types of care that we've seen are delayed. I don't know of any studies that have kind of globally looked at how often care is delayed. You have to have a type of service that makes sense to delay. So we've looked at this in a few settings. So breast cancer, for example, we've looked at whether women delay the steps along the line to getting diagnosed with breast cancer and getting diagnosed with breast cancer. And we found substantial delays. We found delays up to 7 to 8 months by the time you get to that breast cancer diagnosis among women whose employers joined high deductible health plans. We've looked at the same thing with diabetes. We looked at time-sensitive acute diabetes complications and found that people with low-income people, I should say, with diabetes who are in a high deductible health plan delay the outpatient visits for those types of complications. For example, a skin infection, pneumonia, those types of things that urgently need to be treated. We do see delays there, and we've recently published a study about people delaying their diabetes patients, delaying their eye care, their screening for retinopathy, diabetes eye disease. We see up to 4 month delays in that type of service. So I'd say one takeaway is that when we look for delays among people who might delay, we found them. So I'd say it's pretty pervasive based on the current set of studies we've done.
And that, of course, has the propensity for worsening outcomes if you put off care. In previous programs on this topic, we have discovered that throughout the system, if we have a system of health care, throughout the system, we have a tremendous amount of waste. And Dr. Warham, you have said that the term wasteful health care spending does not sufficiently capture the harm that such spending causes populations. How bad is the waste? How serious is the harm?
So, you know, yeah, this is getting back to a comment I made earlier where the term wasteful healthcare spending, you know, could remind someone of a recycling plant where the waste is taken to the recycling plant and turned around and turned into something good. But it's not the case. As we've been discussing, what happens is that wasteful spending ends up hitting the pocketbooks of everybody. And it happens in the employer-based system. It also happens in the public system, because if you are trying to fund a Medicaid program or Medicare and costs keep going up, those costs are going to come from somewhere, for example, increased taxes. So that type of wasteful spending, what we call it financial pollution, is hurting people. And I think, again, this is getting back to what we said, there's not a lot of great research about that. There's not a lot of great research about the extent of those harms and whether people are aware of those. So I think that's an avenue that our research community needs to take up.
Michael.
Yeah, so there's a link between these two discussions, the high deductible discouraging people from getting high value care and the waste or low value care that you were just discussing with Frank. There's a paradigm for insurance called value-based insurance design that tries to remove the barriers to high value care and maybe raise them for the low value care. One of the challenges, in part this relates to people's understanding the system, is employers are offering insurance because they want to attract workers. Workers do not want employers, or for that matter, their insurers, having a heavy hand in how they seek healthcare. So there is often resistance to a range of nuanced insurance products that might steer you and protect you for accessing high value care and steer you away from low value or expensive care. And that tension between who controls your healthcare seeking behavior, what role does the employer play, what role does the insurer play, is very complicated. There are solutions, there's not a lot of momentum to adopt a lot of them because of the control issue, in my opinion.
I would respectfully disagree there, and I agree with all the points you made about transparency and consumerism and is it a false hope, because everyone was on point. But where you see the market responding to that, and I would bring it back to retailization, where you see the market responding to that is with what they call navigation tools. And they are beginning to use artificial intelligence. Some firms are using more people-oriented. In other words, you have a person who helps you. But the whole idea is to help people figure out how to find what they need. And it is always in a time of crisis. No one does this when they don't need healthcare. And that's critical.
I want to let you know, in case you don't, Paul, that Michael is credited as being apparently the co-inventor of value-based care. So you're talking with the creator of that.
Yeah, insurance design. But I would say, I don't mean to turn this into too much of a debate, and we'll let Frank be the referee. There are a lot of these products around. We've known for a long time, for example, that reference pricing, which is a particular type of insurance plan that can steer people to lower price places, can save a lot of money. There's very good studies done from California and other places. The diffusion of that in the marketplace has been very weak. We've done some studies. There's companies, some of these venture-backed companies Paul's talking about, where they will pay you actually to go to a lower price place. We published a study on that. It moved about 1-2% of people. It has been very hard to get, so these solutions exist. A lot of the navigators help you navigate, but they're typically not doing it in a way to save the employer money. They're typically doing it to help you deal with this incredible complexity of care.
Dr. Frank Warham is with Duke University. Dr. Michael Cherno is with Harvard Medical School. And Paul Goldbeck is with Willis Towers Watson. We're talking about the price we pay for insurance and how that impacts the cost of healthcare and the outcomes and more. And we'll continue in a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about insurance, employer-sponsored health insurance, and how that impacts what you pay and what the cost of services are, and whether it will continue to be sustainable in the future, with Dr. Frank Warham, a medical doctor at Duke University. Michael Cherno is a PhD at Harvard Medical School, and Paul Goldbeck is a consultant with Willis Towers Watson. And let me talk about that, because you deal with companies and insurance, et cetera. This pandemic has revealed serious cracks in the social safety net, in the haves and the have-nots, and much, much more. And the same is true with people seeking medical care, because that's what this pandemic was all about. And some of your colleagues, Paul, at Willis Towers Watson say now is the opportune time for employers and health plans to take a hard look at how care is delivered today and to focus on the triple aim of improving quality, cost, and the patient experience. But this country, they also say, is unique in the world in that most healthcare is provided by for-profit entities. So as long as that system prevails, how much control can anyone have over quality, cost, or the patient experience? Paul.
Honestly, I'm not sure I understand why profit or not-for-profit comes into play in that conversation. I think the profit motive can be a powerful one. And I'm not sure, though, that it's a negative one. If you can think of a way to address these problems we've been talking about successfully, and I'll come back to Michael's comments in a second, but if you can figure out a way to address it successfully and document through a measurement strategy that you're having an impact, why should you make a profit for doing that? Because there's going to be a payoff on the back end in terms of actually, again, achieving that triple aim. We're not there yet. I think when it comes to navigation and artificial intelligence, again, we're where the retail industry was 10 or 15 years ago. Who could imagine back then what a shopping experience on Amazon might look like as Amazon got its feet and started to run with their business model? And yet now when you go shopping on the internet, you get prompts based on things you've bought before. It knows who you are as a consumer. It knows where your interests lie. We are on the verge of doing things like that in healthcare. I'm very optimistic. I think the navigation enterprise, in the past, it's been somewhat primitive. It's been people-based. Now, using AI and technology, companies are getting a lot smarter about how they deliver that, and they are helping people to find what they need.
We're seeing it
down to the level of individual condition management.
When you talk about not being able to understand how profits come into this, Dr. Wareham, let me bring you into this, because despite medical costs rising, the New York Times reported about a year ago that the nation's leading health insurers are experiencing, quote, an embarrassment of profits. This during a pandemic in which thousands of people were clogging hospitals, requiring the most expensive care imaginable. How can that be, and what does that say about the need for reform and the role that profits play in keeping our health care and our deductibles high?
Well, you know, the pandemic has been a very special once-in-a-lifetime, we hope, case. And my previous position was closely related to a local health insurer in the New England region, Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare. And so, you know, I sort of had an inside look about what was happening to the health insurance industry during the pandemic. And most people stopped going to the doctor for 3 to 4 to 5 months. And so the bills that the health insurance companies had to pay went way down. So, you know, when your bills go down and you're still collecting premiums, you're going to make a huge profit. So, you know, I can't speak to that particular situation or circumstance. In general, when we're outside of the pandemic times, the health insurers sometimes are profitable and sometimes are not. And I can't speak to, you know, how that should affect their business operations. But certainly you would hope to see a system in which there's more efficiencies and that the health insurers are operating like other businesses where they make a profit if they serve their customers better and they, you know, induce better quality and more efficiency.
Michael Chernow, in addition to your work as a professor of healthcare policy and the director of the Healthcare Markets and Regulations Lab at Harvard Medical School, you are also the chairman of MedPAC. That is an independent agency established by Congress in the 90s to advise them on issues affecting the Medicare program. Medicare covers a lot of people in this country, but haven't you also written that there has to be some sort of price regulation, that markets alone cannot control cost? And has there been any movement or progress toward that end?
Yeah, so first I will emphasize that I am speaking today in my role as a professor, not as my chair as MedPAC, which is nice since we're talking about the commercial market. I think the discussion that you were just having with Frank about insurers and profits and price is an important one. There's a lot of problems in the insurance market, and I don't mean to push past problems in the insurance market, but the core problem we have is the actual cost of delivering care in a range of ways. And there has been an enormous amount of consolidation in the market for providing care, which of course makes shopping very hard and a bunch of other things very challenging. You see very, very wide variation, I mentioned earlier, in prices within a market, showing you that markets aren't working very well. What we have written in the commercial sector is that we call it backstop price regulation, to find where there's the most egregious examples of high pricing and stop and prevent that pricing at the upper end. How you do that is complicated. That is in contrast to more stronger, more government-oriented calls, Medicare for All, public option. There's a bunch of other ways to go about doing this. the basic role of government in this space, one of the basic roles of government in this space is to work to help the system when markets fail. And there's a lot of places where I think you can argue clearly that markets are failing. There's clear evidence that when hospitals merge, for example, prices go up and quality doesn't get better. So there's a role for some level of price regulation. My personal view is that should be very modest and done with care, because there's deleterious consequences of driving down prices too quickly and too bluntly.
But whether we have transparency or not, it seems to me that healthcare providers can charge whatever they damn well please for anything. It's the capitalist way. General Motors can charge whatever they want for a car.
No, they can't charge whatever they please. There are limits in terms of what people will pay in a range of ways. But of course, as competition diminishes, those limits become weaker. And that's why you need levels of regulation where that happens. But if they could charge whatever they wanted, believe me, they would charge even more than they do, and they charge a lot now. I think thinking about how to jump in where markets are failing and provide direct solutions so people don't have to pay, so premiums can be lower. There's only so much that Paul's going to be able to do to help his employers when he's facing a consolidated market and employers that don't want to steer workers away from the preferred facilities in their markets.
Dr. Wareham, let me go back to something you were talking about earlier, and that is you brought up some examples of people delaying care and the impact on their health because they either couldn't afford the deductibles or they didn't have insurance and couldn't afford the care. And one of the things that you've written about is a study that documents this that includes low-income patients with high deductible health care plans who avoided the emergency room when they had chest pains, and they ended up in the hospital anyway following a heart attack. In the end, doesn't that cost everyone more?
So, you know, that study showed that there were, among low-income people who had chest pain, they're more likely to have a follow-up heart attack hospitalization after that emergency department visit. So it's kind of a special subsegment of the population. But yes, we did see that. And yes, those would be more expensive. Those events would be more expensive. The challenge actually in studying high deductible health plans and costs is that they do reduce costs. So they reduce people going to the emergency department for less severe things. So you have on the one hand, you have some services where costs are going down because those high deductibles prevent people from seeing the doctor for things they might not, or going to settings they might not need to be in. Like you don't need to go to the emergency department when you have a cold. And high deductible health plans reduce those. But then on the other hand, it turns out that some costs are going up. So there's this mix. And a lot of the work we do tries to disentangle that mix. But I think it's crucial to look for those events because in a sense, the importance is maybe you can't make the argument that high deductible health plans are making costs go up because it seems that they might go down 4%, something like that. But they're harming people, subsegments of the population, and those people are getting higher costs, and that's an ethical problem. And so that's the area that we really need to focus on. We've had a lot of pessimistic discussion here, but I want to get back really quickly to the idea of value-based insurance design because, you know, on a more positive note, we found that those types of designs generally work. They preserve the care that's high value when you reduce the cost for those. And so I think that's a direction that Michael certainly advocated for, that we see good evidence for. And I think that's, we've been talking about solutions, and that's at least one solution in the short term for improving the value of care.
But Michael, as the co-inventor of value-based care, I believe it's accurate to say that you have said that this really is not a way to save money. If you said that, what is it then?
So if you lower the amount that people have to pay to get high value care, you encourage more high value care, as Frank said. Most high value care is cost effective, not cost saving. Spending doesn't go down, even when you sort of push that out into the future. The way to save money would be to use less low value care and to steer people to lower price places. And value-based insurance design has two components. One is lowering cost sharing for high value services. That portion of it does not save money, but it gives people access to care that they need, which is sort of the entire point. And then the other part is raising cost sharing for low value care. That's much harder to do and a much longer conversation to figure out how to do that. So what value-based insurance design has typically been in the marketplace now is it's been a way to protect people when faced with high deductibles from the most deleterious consequences of those high deductibles. The saving is the high deductible. The value-based insurance design minimizes or reduces the bad consequences of that.
Employers, Paul, have been taking a hard look at how to change the paradigm here and save some money and also provide the care that their employees say that they value. Some of it's worked, some of it has not. Some companies have steered the employees to lower cost providers. They've even flown their employees to other cities because the care that they need is cheaper in those cities. I'm curious, what of those things have worked well and have been responded to well by employees?
I think there are a number of examples, and you mentioned a couple generally, and there's a couple of different things. One is common name is centers of excellence. So for high cost procedures, open heart surgery, transplants, employers, there are known quality criteria in terms of who does it better, who gets better outcomes, who gets people back to work more quickly. And employers, together with others who help them with the work, identify who those providers are. And to your point, they provide incentives in the benefit design to steer people to those places. We've seen it with joint replacement, where you create a separate provider network to do knee and hip replacements, for example. And many of them are expanding now to include back surgery. And back surgery, I'm not the physician on this panel, but I think both physicians would agree that if there is an area where there's room for debate about quality outcomes and the actual impact of what we're spending, back surgery is a big one. And so those are two examples. The other thing we're seeing is deploying technology to help people manage conditions that they have. And so, for example, diabetes is a great example. There are companies out there now who leverage technology, who leverage instant feedback between the patient and the care team to actually reverse stage 2 diabetes and help to improve health that way. So increasingly what we're seeing is employers will take a very intense focus on a narrow piece of their plan in terms of what is a problem, and then dive deep into that in terms of identifying solutions. And it can include patient support, it can include narrower provider networks, centers of excellence, all kinds of things. And in many cases, they are documented to have a positive impact.
So we have 2 minutes left in this program. Michael, I want to go back to MedPAC for just a second and your work with Medicare. There was a report recently that MedPAC recommended that Medicare be able to negotiate prices for injectable drugs. Those are the shots that the doctor gives you. They're not over-the-counter medications. Given the reluctance of Congress to allow Medicare to negotiate prices on anything, what's the chance of that happening?
Well, the overarching issue for your audience, I think, is people have different opinions about how well the government functions writ large. A well-functioning government will do a great job. A poorly functioning government, maybe not as much. In the drug space, it's complicated because we need innovation. So you're paying for future drugs as much as you're paying for the drugs you have now. I can't speak to the politics of the likelihood that any of these types of drug negotiation bills will move forward. They hinge on this tension between will the government be able to set the right price, which is high enough to encourage innovation but low enough to protect consumers. And that is a very politically contentious point because it involves people disputing the fundamental role of government in our society. And that's well beyond what I can talk about.
And Paul, we have about 25 seconds left here, so I'm going to ask you an unfair question. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce is opposed to Medicare for All, the single-payer plan. They say it would be highly disruptive and result in employer-sponsored insurance being displaced by an untested experimental program. Given everything we've talked about, why would businesses be against this?
The first thing that comes to mind is because they want the flexibility to manage their own programs and develop their own solutions to assess their needs individually and create their strategy to address those needs individually.
And we'll leave it at that. You get the last word. Paul Goldbeck is a consultant in large market health and the benefits lead with Willis Towers Watson. They consult other companies on controlling risks and costs. Dr. Frank Warham is a professor of medicine at Duke University, and Michael Cherno is professor of healthcare policy and director of the Healthcare Markets and Regulations Lab at Harvard Medical School. Thank you all for the hour. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.